I think this might be one sermon. There might be more to come. I don't know. We just have to see what happens. But you turn to Ezekiel chapter 22. Ezekiel chapter 22. I don't get much opportunity to ever quote or read from Ezekiel. This is one of those times. And we're going to start our reading in verse 23. Now, what's going on here with Ezekiel is that he is prophesying that judgments were coming for Israel. And they are coming with good cause. God never practiced a judgment at any particular time out of whim or caprice. There was always a reason for it. There was always a cause. You reap what you sow, as we mentioned this morning. But now we take up our reading in Ezekiel chapter 22, verse 23. Read down through verse 31. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, say to her, You are a land that is not cleansed or rained on in the day of indignation. There is a conspiracy of her prophets in her midst, like a roaring lion tearing the prey. They have devoured lives. They have taken treasure and precious things. They have made many widows in the midst of her. Her priests have done violence to my law and have profaned my holy things. They have made no distinction between the holy and the profane, and they have not taught the difference between the clean and the unclean. And they hid their eyes from my Sabbath, and I am profaned among them. Her princes within her are like wolves tearing the prey by shedding blood and destroying lives in order to get dishonest gain. Her prophets have smeared whitewash for them, seeing false visions and divining lies for them, saying, Thus says the Lord God, when the Lord has not spoken. The people of the land have practiced oppression and committed robbery, and they have wronged the poor and needy and have oppressed the sojourner without justice. I searched for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand in the gap before me for the land so that I would not destroy it. But I found no one. Thus, I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Their way I have brought upon their heads, declares the Lord God. Some of those things sound awful familiar, don't they? Hard to believe it happened so long ago with Israel being carried off into captivity. And so, you know, one of the things, though, we learn is that the world, time, life, and everything else all continue much as they have from the beginning. Now, one more time from the Old Testament, this time from the book of Ecclesiastes. And we want to take a look at chapter 1. We will read verses 3 through 11. Ecclesiastes 1, 3 through 11. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes, and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along. On its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, See, this, it is new? already it has existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. I think those passages bear out the fact that things continue as they have from the beginning, and there's no new thing. I think sometimes it's just dressed up a little bit, but a lot of times it's the same thing. Now, even the gospel, which is almost 2,000 years old, has neither changed in its message nor diminished in its power, despite all of the calls for some sort of modernization. I guess we've heard all of this. I think that there was probably at one time some kind of a call as to what are we going to do with all these baby boomers and reach them with the gospel message? And then what are we going to do with the nuclear family and reach them with the gospel message? What are we going to do with the generation X, Y, Z and whatever it is? And now today, it's we need a gospel for the millennials. How are we going to reach the millennials? Every once in a while, on Facebook, there'll be somebody who's a member of the church, and they'll find something someplace on some website from some evangelical church, and they're all tore up and bothered about trying to come up with a gospel message for millennials. And I've looked at this and I thought, oh boy, that's just kind of the trendy thing. But I think that there is a message for millennials. I think there is. And I think I know what it would be. Here would be the message. 3 points. Sin is real. Jesus saves. Obey the gospel. I think that'd be the message for millennials. I think that'd be the message for anybody. This idea that there's a specialized... Is there a specialized gospel for seniors? Is there a specialized gospel for a family? Is there one for single people? And so on it goes. Where does all this come from? There's one gospel for one people, regardless of if whatever they are. Anyway. But I'll tell you what, these millennial-seeking churches are not going to preach something like that. You won't hear it. Now, they'll hear something. Turn on the TV. Watch one of these programs. They'll hear something. What they're hearing is not the gospel. Sin's just about disappeared. You got to reach millennials, so let's leave that first part there out, sin. Let's leave it out. We've kind of canceled that and neutralized it. Or we've argued it away. And we've become more enlightened and we're reaching out further and so on. And we're more tolerant in this and so on it goes. So, you see, we're told that things have changed, and so the gospel needs to change. So you see this rise of a certain spin of things. It's amazing to me that sometimes you can put a spin on something which seems like a completely innocuous question. Amazing. Now this isn't it, but this is just an example of it. Talking about this yesterday, I think. We were at the meeting at Bedford. And Friday night, there's a couple people there. Their last name's Pancake. It's Dale and Marcy. Good folks, real good folks. They've come out of denominationalism. He works at a place that sells and services big diesel trucks. Volvo's one of them. I don't remember the other. He's been working on some of the men that he works with there. He's a supervisor. And trying to get them to come to the meeting. And he did bring somebody with him Friday night. Now, the man he brought with him Friday night asked Brother Pancake, said, is this a black church?
And Brother Pancake says, no, it's a brick church. You know, I thought, good answer. Good answer. So you see, you know, you can put spin on things, right? And what difference does it make? You know, if it would be a black church or a brick church, if the gospel is being preached, good enough. But what we've got today is a question. Now, you might be asked this at some time. I've been on the lookout and watching for this to maybe appear around here someplace on the church signs, you know, out in the lawn, or maybe a banner across the front of the building, like you're going to see here. And it looks like that, you know. Are you an accepting church? All are welcome. You see the flag there, don't you? See the banner. You know what that represents. But they'll ask, are you an accepting church? I think probably in my trying to be naive about it. I know what it means. I know what they mean, but I'll try to be naive. And my answer would be, yes, we accept anyone who believes in Jesus, repents of their sins, and are baptized. That's not what they mean, is it? No. That's not the focus of the question right there. Focus of the question is, do you accept people of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender persuasion? How long has the push to accept sinful behavior as acceptable been around? Long time. There's nothing new under the sun. About the last 30 years. Have there been some real changes made in morality? Has there been a shifting of standards? Is what was once evil good, good evil? Has that kind of thing happened? You know, again, in Isaiah's day, one of the woes that are pronounced there in Isaiah chapter 5 is that woe to them who call evil good and good evil. Back in Isaiah's day, centuries before the time of Christ. It's almost 3,000 years old. Have you noticed these changes? I'd say that you have. And do these changes bother you? Whether we realize it or not, we're in the midst of a war on morality. And it's not the Bible that's changing. It's not changing. It hasn't changed. I think it's the attitude and standards of the world that are changing. We talked about this some in Bible study this morning. Now, just real brief, what is the modern state of Christianity? What's it like? Well, sometimes now, the modern state, now not what it should be. I'm not talking about that. We're not going to go here to the Bible and look for an answer on this. The modern state of Christianity. Sometimes it's described as being as having this secular influence. Whatever's going on in the world eventually leaks over into the church, like it or not. Now, the word secular means of or relating to worldly things or to things that are not regarded as religious, spiritual, or sacred, temporal things. And these things that are out here of the world, eventually they come in. And then there's also the idea that the church is influenced by views of moral relativism. Being morally relative is the philosophized notion that right and wrong are not absolute values, but they are personalized according to the individual and his or her circumstances or cultural orientation. That's a long way of saying that, you know, whatever's like back in the time of Judges, everybody just does whatever's right in their own eyes. Now, compounding this, and this is always a mystery to me. I've just always been curious about this, you know. The United States has been called a Christian nation. You hear that all the time. This is a Christian nation. I'm thinking it is, son. But anyway, what if you tried to define that? Or what if you had someone who said this all the time? How about during the election cycle when everybody's going on about a Christian nation and pretending, you know, that they're interested in religion and other things like that? What if you were to ask one of them? Excuse me there. What is a Christian nation? You know, I got an idea. You'd get some stammering and stuttering and spitting and looking off into the distance. What I'm saying is, it's just ill-defined. And I wonder if saying this all the time, now see, we're a Christian nation, and is this drum beat so long that people finally decide, well, you know what? I'm a citizen of the Christian nation, so I must be a Christian. And whatever we decide must be right and part of Christian doctrine or theology, whatever. I wonder. I don't know. I don't think that's impossible. Kind of a shallow view, I understand, but lots of people have shallow views on a lot of things. And there's a lesson to learn from just looking across the Atlantic Ocean at Europe. You know, Europe was the cradle of the Reformation. Think about it. Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, all these names from history, and all of the things that they stood for, making a break away from Rome, and the popularity of this. You know, there were, you know, Germany. Germany became, you know, just overwhelmingly Protestant. So did Switzerland. A few other countries, they made great inroads into this. And for a while, Europe leaned heavily towards being non-Catholic. But what happens? Well, now if you go over there and you look at some of these places, those large cathedrals are largely empty. What's happened? What happened over there? Well, what happened over there, they got too much of the world brought in and followed, and they followed it. There were too much delving into politics. And I don't know how else to explain this. It's subjectivism, but let me call it feel-goodism replaced the gospel. Feels good, do it. Been doing that. They've been doing that kind of thing for a long, long time. Now, I think we can learn a lesson from this. And we can look at the scriptures and see that not doing these kinds of things is according to what God's Word has to say. You turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we're going to look at verses 18 through 29. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 through 29. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Is not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks seek for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now let me pause there. And be sure to point out that there is no foolishness of God and there is no weakness of God. It's kind of a play on words here, if you will, or on the line of thought. In other words, if there was a foolishness of God, if there was a weakness of God, it would still be greater than anything that man's got. Consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he might nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. What's he saying there? He's saying there, it's not supposed to be after man and the wisdom of man. Like these things down here. Like that. It's supposed to be after God. And then Paul writes in Galatians chapter 1 and verse 11, he says, you know, the gospel that I preach, the gospel I've learned, the gospel I preach, the gospel I've received, he says, it's not after man. I didn't get it from man, and I'm not going over here and trying to please man with it. And so that's something to learn. Quite the contrast to the modern state of Christianity. Now, another thing is that we want to be sure and point out here that it is a war. That's the correct word to use. It is a war. But now, it's not a physical war. No, and if you go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we find that over there. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Now, some folks have looked at this and they say, okay, you know, well, we're not in a physical war. That's right. And that's right. And these passages would be used to prove that. But the problem is that people say, well, we're not in a physical war. And then they would go into the next point, which they think follows. And it is, we're not in any kind of war at all. Really? Well, there's the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. Well, what are they of? They're spiritual weapons that we've got. And understand that it's a warfare because you know what they're doing? Look at verse 5. They're taking captives. Now they're taking thoughts captive. And they're taking these thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ. If you think about the war and the battleground's right in here. In my head, your head, everybody's head. And that's what the prize is. And well, here's the devil, our adversary, and he wants our thoughts to be over here in his way and following his will. And then on the other hand, these thoughts are God seeking them and to bring them into subjection. That's what the war is all about. It's about our thoughts. See? And it's a physical war. It's not a physical war. It's a spiritual war. We're told in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3, and you know the passage over there, to be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. I'm ahead of myself there. That's coming there in 2 Timothy 2, verse 3. You know, I saw this passage. I'm trying to think when I saw this the other day. And that really stimulated things. But it's 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11. Where he said, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust. Now watch, which wage war against the soul. Are we involved in that? Is there a war being waged against the soul? Now, if some people are right, you know, and oh, well, there's just no war whatsoever, you know, for Christians and all. I think we've already given up. And it wars against the soul. What do we do? Nothing? Is there no defense? Is there nothing that we do whatsoever? And yet we're told to be a good soldier of Jesus Christ? Which seems to me that somebody's wrong here with their thinking. Well, we are in a war, and we're supposed to be good soldiers. The background up there on the screen, that would be that up in there and all, that's from Ephesians chapter 6. You know Ephesians chapter 6. And you get in there where it's Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 18, shield of faith, helmet of salvation, the sword that's the spirit of the truth, and you put on all these pieces of what is called the gospel armor. Put on the whole armor of God. Don't leave any pieces off. And someone will come along and accurately say, well, actually, the finest fighting machine of the first century was the Roman soldier. And that's right. Got the breastplate, got everything you know that's necessary. Got the loins and the waist girded about. Yeah. Greatest fighting machine that existed in the first century. And so in describing the armor of God, it describes it using that as an example. And here's the, this isn't just, you know, dress armor where you dress up in it and then, you know, and people say, oh, you look real nice, you know, and that's about it. It's not just for show. The armor there is battle armor. But why is it battle armor? Because there's a war going on. And the war is centering on morality. Now, Paul, writing to Timothy, a couple letters to Timothy, and in 1 Timothy, in chapter 6 and verse 12, he says, to fight the good fight of faith. I really wonder what some people do with that passage, some brethren do with that passage. And then later on, as Paul is writing in 2 Timothy, and a lot of people say he's writing this right about the end of his life, and he says, writing to Timothy, well, I have fought the good fight. So there's a good fight. Now it's a fight of faith, which would indicate, you know, it's a spiritual battle. So it is a war. And we would just be ill-served if we decide to stick our head in the sand and pretend that this isn't what's happening. Look at all the things that are going on. It's a war. And the proponents in the opposition, they're pressing the war on anyone who wants to say there's a right and a wrong. It doesn't matter what the subject is. If you just say that there's a right and a wrong, and people are just beside themselves. I got the idea that someplace off in private, and they won't do this in public, but you say, oh, well, there's a right and a wrong, and they go over here in private someplace, and they throw dust in the air and tear at their hair, rub gravel through their hair, whatever they, you know, just they're just beside themselves over this. Maybe they dress in sackcloth and ashes, But it's just the response of this. They're just horrified that someone would think that there's right and wrong. Why don't you come out of the dark ages? Why don't you grow up? Why don't you get in the 21st century? Now, what is our response, actually, to things like worldliness? Can we recognize that? And worldliness, you know, with things like dancing and drinking and gambling. You know, it used to be that those things were kind of preached on every once in a while. And they were called sin. Maybe not so much anymore. And then there's racism. That's wrong. I don't care. That's one of the biggest blights we've ever had on our country is racism. But it's not always white and black. There are actually other races. And if you think that there hasn't been racism with another race that's not white or black, well, again, you've just had your head in the sand. But it exists. What do you do about it? From what I see right now, there's not much being done on either side to help this matter. I don't think that rioting and burning down things and killing police officers, assassinating police officers, I don't think that's the answer. I think it's a heart problem. How about this practice of abortion? Another great blight on our country. Yippee-i-yo-ki-yay. The United States has led all the world into the area of abortion. Obscenity. I got that misspelled anyway. There are things that will be said now that nobody would dream of saying in public. And they'll say it, and you remember, I'm not going to repeat it, but do you remember Gone with the Wind and what Clark Gable said in that movie? How's that compared to what's said today? Oh, my lands. No comparison. And you know the amazing part of this is you've got grade school children that are out here someplace, you'll see them somewhere, and they'll just curse at you like a stevedore. Immodesty, same thing. People are doing things and so on. And you know, I told Martha one time, I said, I wish I could take my eyes and my brain out and wash them sometimes, you know. Fornication, that's the old word. And in the Bible, fornication stood for premarital sex, adultery, homosexuality, all those things. Let me ask you this. Now, this war on morality that's going on, is there one side that's promoting and pushing these things? Is there? I think so. Wanting more and more and more. You think, how could there be any more? But they're wanting more and more and more. Yeah. And now, is there any pushback? Who's going to do the pushback? Your congressman? Your mayor? Your senator? Your president? The Supreme Court? Who's going to do the pushback? Well, it's those that are going to believe in the Bible and believe these things to be sinful. There's where the pushback's going to be. Few that there are. And the thing is, you know, not to compromise. It says in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3, let's look at it. We got time here. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3, it says, but immorality, and that's fornication, or any impurity or greed must not even be named among you as is proper among saints. Not even named among you. It shouldn't even be said that these things are going on. The only way they go on would be, you know, if you just start to compromise. You just surrender. You're not in the fight at all. You've given up. You've been taken captive. And another one here is that we need to be careful, and this in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Go over there, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. You know, if someone, if a woman wears a veil, you know, back in the Old Testament there were veils that men, Moses wore one. If you wear a veil, you don't see clearly through the veil. And so Satan would like to put a veil on everybody's eyes so they can't see the truth of the gospel. And he'd like to put on a heavy veil, just as heavy as it can be. So we need to be careful that our eyes don't become blinded, that we can't see what the truth is. Now, you might take your songbooks, turn the songs been selected. As I said, there'll be more. It's not all gloom and doom, you know. I think to myself sometimes, it's such a relief, and it ought to be for all of us, that we can come to a gathering of brethren. And we leave this stuff behind us. We're not inundated, we're not bombarded by this constant drumbeat to promote these things. We can come here and we can really find what the idea of sanctuary is. A place where there can be some rest, some respite. And that we can have folks of like mind. It's hard to find that out in the world. Their chances are real good that you won't find that. And sometimes you won't even find that among people who claim to be Christians themselves. Anyway, a choice needs to be made to fight the good fight of faith. I've got here, I'm just going to read part of it, Romans chapter 6. I've always been fond. Romans chapter 6, verse 12 through 18, but we'll just do 16, 17. Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in righteousness? Well, there's the two choices. Then he says, verse 17, but thanks be to God that though you were slaves of sin. You were. Past tense. You became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching to which you were committed. You entered the fight willingly. A decision was made. And you continue that fight. Are you a child of God? Would you become one tonight? If you are a child of God, fallen by the wayside, maybe been caught up in these kinds of things, turn yourself around. Fight the good fight of faith. If we can help you to do that, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.